A steady flow of traffic continues to pass by the empty Mission Gateway development on Johnson Drive and Row. It's a place that's been at the center of hope and frustration for people who live in Mission and Roland Park. Thomas Harris's law firm is across the street from the empty development.
Just tired of all the fuss here, you know? I mean, something needs to happen.
He's talking about the vacant site that used to be Mission Mall. When the mall was new in the 1990s, it was seriously the place to be, with its frozen yogurt in stores like The Limited and Express. Now, the empty lot looks just like it did when the mall was torn down 10 years ago. In fact, it's been 3 years since Thomas Harris told us he was tired of it. The fuss, as he describes it, has mostly been about whether a Walmart should be part of the new development. Mission Mayor Steve Schoenger just broke a city council tie in favor of Walmart. But the whole debacle got us thinking. There seems to be a desire for more mom-and-pop shops like the ones further west down Johnson Drive. Meanwhile, area residents have been skeptical of trusty old Walmart as a prospective neighbor. Is there a shift in how people are viewing big box retailers? I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and Steve Vakrod of The Pitch. I want to ask you that question. You've been reporting on business and development in Kansas City for a while now. Are you seeing a shift in how people feel about big box stores in their neighborhoods?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that given how Kansas City has developed over the years, you know, if you look at an area like Metcalf and Overland Park, where there's just been this proliferation of big box stores, I think there's sort of a stylistic mutation, if you will, on the part of consumers, whereas big box stores offer a lot of convenience in terms of finding a lot of the things that you need. The architecture of them doesn't always look too great, and they go in and out of business. It's hard to fill them up.
And yeah, talk about that out of business piece, because that is tricky.
Right. So here's a great example. You know, you look at the city of Marion. They built that huge retaining wall that everybody sees when they drive down I-35, and that was supposed to be anchored by a Circuit City. And then, right in the midst of the recession, and right before that Circuit City was supposed to open, Circuit City went out of business. And when you have these shopping centers that are anchored by a big box, the idea is that, you know, other smaller stores will see all that foot traffic going into the big electronics retailer, in the case of Circuit City, and they might pass to get a cup of coffee at the Starbucks or get a haircut or something like that. Well, because Circuit City didn't go in, nothing went in, and that thing stood empty for a long time. It was a huge problem for Merriam. Somewhat ironically, they fixed that with a big box. But the difference with something like IKEA is that it's unique to the market. I think where people are starting to get a little weary in certain parts of the city is kind of the same old retailers, you know, the particularly Walmart, where, you know, if you draw a 50-mile radius, you know, around, say, Mission, there's 42 Walmarts in a 50-mile radius. So I think people want to see things that are unique. There's people gravitating towards locally owned stores, things of that nature, things that make their communities unique and not like a lot of the other ones around them.
But you're saying things that make the community unique, whether that's a big national chain and it's the only location in our metro, for example, or if it's a mom and pop.
Right. You know, a combination of the two. I mean, look what Trader Joe's did to Ward Parkway Mall. That was a big part of sort of revitalizing that mall, because Trader Joe's had always had kind of this buzz and kind of this mystique, you know, that I always had a little bit of trouble understanding, but a lot of people really like it. And if you go on a Sunday around 4 o'clock to Trader Joe's at Ward Parkway Mall, it's packed. And so that's a unique retailer. You know, something like an Apple store, you know, which you can find in a lot of places, but it has sort of an air of exclusivity, and those stores do very well. And Walmarts actually still do very well, but there tends to be a type of stigma associated with Walmart, which exists for a lot of different reasons.
Just a couple of those reasons?
Well, one reason is that they put downward pressure on pricing for smaller local businesses. So, for example, You know, there's a hardware store on Johnson Drive, and I haven't spoken to them, but I suspect they may be a little bit worried about a Walmart coming in where they could undercut their prices. They would have the ability to undercut their prices on hardware supplies. You know, there's a lot of literature out there that suggests when a Walmart comes into a city, it can have adverse effects on smaller, locally owned businesses that just can't compete with the prices that Walmart offers. Another one is if Walmart leaves, and they do have the tendency from time to time to just find a different location, and if they leave their old facility empty, those aren't easy to turn into other things. They tend to stick around and stay empty, and that has an effect on a community.
We just heard about this 10-year back and forth between Mission and Roland Park residents, their elected officials, and retail developers. What can you tell us about those conversations? Who wanted what?
Well, we could go on for a couple of shows about what's gone on there. Basically, when the current developer of that project took it over in about 2005 and demolished the old mall, he started with these visions of a development that would include a hotel and some office space and some condos and some retail, and shifted so many times over the years up to a point where he was proposing an aquarium, you know, this huge aquarium that he thought would be kind of a landmark attraction in the Midwest. He wasn't able to sew up the financing for that. So he kind of had this upward trajectory over the years of these plans getting more and more grandiose, if you will, and kind of set this expectation that he would create something unique for Mission Gateway. And when you call a project a gateway, you're kind of suggesting that it's the entrance of your community. And for Mission, that's true because you have all that traffic coming south from Roe Avenue that enters Mission, and you have the traffic coming back and forth on Shawnee Mission Parkway. And so that area is kind of the most visible piece of property. And so when people have this expectation of, you know, this is going to be truly unique for our community, and then after some time, and he comes back and says, all right, we're going to anchor this thing with a Walmart, and it's going to be a special Walmart. And I think,
yeah, what's special about it?
Well, he kind of suggested that it would be, you know, architecturally unique, for instance, and that there would be some retail on top of it, and it would be the kind of Walmart that we haven't seen. And then as time went on and he couldn't get a retailer to agree to be on top of Walmart because that makes accessibility a little bit of a challenge, he sort of changed it to, well, it'll be like the Walmart on in South Overland Park on 159th Street, where you have this brick facade and these flourishes that make it look nicer than, you know, kind of four walls and a ceiling. And I think, you know, my impression from the community in Mission, going to meetings and watching them online, is that they weren't really terribly impressed with the suggestion that a Walmart would be dramatically different. And going back to that theme of a gateway for a city, you know, is the gateway for our city, Mission, our small kind of unique suburb, going to be a Walmart anchored project? And I think that's kind of where the rub is coming in for residents and some members of the city council.
I'm interested that people are wanting this uniqueness. That isn't what, like, historically suburbs have been known for wanting.
Right. And, you know, if you look at Mission itself, if you kind of go to the west portion of Johnson Drive, you have a lot of chain restaurants. You know, you have your Chick-fil-A's, you have your Runza's, you have your Pie Fives. And those are, you know, some of those are a little bit more unique as far as chains go. But then as you go further east on Johnson Drive, you have sort of your kind of smaller, locally owned, quirky shops. You have Fluffy Fresh Donuts, you have Lamar's Donuts, you have Werner Sausages, things like that. And I think if you drive down there, it has kind of a cool sort of Main Street type, you know, small town Main Street type of appeal. Well, then if you kind of bookend that with a Walmart, I think there's some concern that, you know, you're putting another chain, a chain that exists a mile up the road in Roland Park, and you're not really doing anything terribly unique, and you may have an effect on the existing businesses in Mission.
Does the indecision that paralyzed this community for a whole decade represent some kind of identity crisis for Kansas City's inner ring suburbs?
I don't know that it's so much of an identity crisis on the part of the residents as the inability for the developer to really get the project going. I mean, he has a plan right now that he is, you know, that again features a Walmart, it features some apartments, a hotel, an A-Loft hotel, which already exists in Leawood, and possibly some office space. But of course, again, the anchor of it is going to be this Walmart. And what I'm seeing when I go to these meetings is a lot of opposition just to the idea of a Walmart. And the last time it came up to the city council to decide on a site plan, and a site plan is really just determining whether the design of the plan conforms with zoning laws. It's not really kind of a yes or no on the project. And typically these things pass if the planning commission gives a recommendation. But even despite that, you had members of the city council saying, this isn't really what we want on the community. We can do better than this. And even some of the ones who voted yes on the project kind of couched their yes vote as, well, we're just doing what our planning commission told us to do. So he's going to have to come back with a development agreement that may include, probably will include public incentives. And I think that's when you're going to kind of see the discussion take a different level on the council.
Benjamin Newman, with us from the political science department at UC Riverside, do people think differently about what a thriving suburb is and should be in the 21st century?
Hi, thanks for having me. Well, it really depends how you look at it. I was invited on the show because of a study that I did looking at public opinion toward big box stores. And I guess kind of the background interest that led me to this was I've lived in various cities throughout the country, and one thing I've noticed is patterns of gentrification that have been happening over the last 10 years, where you have a lot of young, higher socioeconomic status, well-educated folks from the suburbs moving back into the cities. And the U.S. Census in 2010 kind of indicates this, that there's been kind of this return of people in their 20s and 30s into urban areas. And one of the main reasons given by people is that they're seeking out character. They're seeking out character in architecture, in businesses, in community. And a big part of that is tied into this go local movement. So I would say that the answer to your question is yes, but among a certain subset of the population.
So, and does that mean like only in certain kinds of suburbs?
That I cannot speak to. I don't have the data on that.
As you mentioned, you wrote this paper. It's called Backlash Against the Big Box, Local Small Business and Public Opinion Toward Business Corporations. How exactly did you go about studying public opinion on this?
Sure. So I went to the Pew Research Center, which is a nonpartisan kind of policy think tank. And on a regular basis, they conduct random representative samples of the American public where each survey will have about 2,000 Americans, adult Americans from throughout the country. And my co-author and I found a couple of surveys that actually asked respondents in the survey questions probing their attitudes toward Walmart, various different questions about Walmart, and then toward a few other big box stores such as Home Depot and Target. And these surveys reported each respondent's zip code and county FIPS code of residence. So we're able to match their responses in terms of their attitudes toward Walmart to data from the Census Bureau, the county business patterns data, to find out if there is a systematic relationship between the amount of big box stores in people's surrounding local economy and their attitudes toward Walmart.
What did you find?
So what we found are things that comport with what your other speaker was saying, which is that the average American, as their local surrounding economy moves from being one characterized by a dominance of small mom-and-pop businesses to a dominance of large corporate retailers, there is a significant increase in the probability that they will report a variety of negative attitudes. So to put that in simpler terms, when there's more big box stores, people like Walmart a lot less. And we measure that in terms of a question that just asks how favorable or unfavorable do you find Walmart? Also, in terms of their thoughts about whether Walmart is good for the country and whether it's a good place to work. And we find across the board, compared to people that live in environments where there's more small businesses, people that live in environments where there's more big box stores think that Walmart is unfavorable, they think it's bad for the country, and they're more likely to think it's a bad place to work.
Do you know what their arguments are? I mean, it's interesting because there has in the past been that conventional wisdom about the importance of the big box anchor for suburban retail, but it sounds like people who live in communities where that's played out don't see it being beneficial, don't have that opinion.
So in this study, we didn't actually get into, I guess, what we would call the mechanisms that sit between those two variables that we found, large retail business and their attitudes. However, there is a wealth of more case study-based research that goes and asks individuals in depth, say maybe 40 individuals in a community where a controversy like the one being discussed here is happening, and asks them, what do you think about Walmart? What do you like? What don't you like? And then people can report that. What we did in this study is we looked across thousands and thousands of Americans in hundreds of communities and sought to see whether there is a systematic relationship. So we didn't really, our study didn't really speak to what was going on, the minutiae in people's heads, but just whether there was that relationship in general.
Have you read those case studies you referenced?
I have. I read those when I was delving into this project. And yeah, the types of things that people espouse as reasons for not liking big box development are very in line with what your other speaker was talking about, which is people are concerned about the displacement of mom and pop businesses. And they're concerned about the transformation of, say, a central business district or a shopping center that has a lot of unique mom and pops where you know the owner, you know the owner's kids, maybe they're in soccer together, the owner of the business contributes a lot, and the transformation of that into an environment where people that were self-employed business owners are now just another kind of grunt in the line at a big box store. I think people have those concerns. And I think that people also have kind of character concerns. I mean, a lot of people will look at like a development of tract homes that all look the same and find that less appealing than looking at, say, an area of a city where there are kind of craftsmen or custom homes. And I think you could export that to like a business environment.
Steve Vakrat, when you look at what parts of town are really drawing people to them right now versus what parts of town maybe were the really like appealing places to be 20 years ago in Kansas City, I mean, what are you seeing? Just as a casual observer, to me, when I think about the mom and pop store, people have always had a certain amount of nostalgia and affection for those. But there was a time when they were considered risky. And from what I observed, the big national chains used to really generate lots and lots of excitement. They were like shiny new things. And when a big store arrived in the Kansas City metro, the overwhelming feeling was that we were finally getting access to something we hadn't had before. And people who favored mom and pops were like a little more fringe. They were seen as kind of sentimental. Is that the same picture that you see now?
Yeah, I see some of that. You know, when it comes to big box stores, there's sort of this feeling of disconnect, I think, that people have. And it's a real struggle for cities, you know, city planning departments to deal with. You know, big box stores are typically owned by faraway corporations, and the decisions that they make tend not to take the local community so much in their mind when they make decisions about, are we going to continue with this location? And if we aren't, you know, how is this property going to be disposed? A good example of that would be the Kmart/Sears that was on Antioch and Shawnee Mission Parkway. So just as Merriam fixes one problem with this IKEA, now they're having to sort through what they're going to do with this very large, very large building that's largely empty. And,
you know,
and there's a tax issue for a small city when a retailer like that leaves as well, when a big chunk of like a whole block is taken up by one retailer.
Right. And that's where cities have to be really careful about, you know, how they invest in retail and how they plan for retail, because, you know, just take the enclosed mall model for instance. You know, for decades that was the popular retail development. You have this big behemoth of a building, and they tended to be sort of architecturally kind of Lego piece looking projects, but they were wildly popular. And over time, consumer tastes have changed, and a lot of them are not as popular as they used to be. I mean, Oak Park Mall's kind of stood the test of time, but nearby Metcalf South did not. You had Bannister Mall that didn't stand the test of time. And as they close, it has a kind of metastasizing effect on surrounding communities. And then cities have to, you know, come up with plans, you know, like tax increment financing, as they did with the as they did with Bannister, to remake that into an office park for Cerner. Now with Metcalf South, there was talk about, you know, using a lot of public money to turn it into another retail center. These incentives last for a long time. So after 20 years, do consumer tastes change again into those places? Does obsolescence take root once again?
It's curious. I mean, do you think that some of the examples you just provided are like dollars and cents type cases in favor of the mom and pop over the large scale retailer? Or is the argument in favor of the mom and pop still essentially a squishier argument?
Well, it's hard to say, particularly if you're a landowner and a developer. So, you know, just take Mission Gateway, for example. You know, if the developer were to just dispense with Walmart and say, okay, I don't want to deal with Walmart, I'm just going to sign all local tenants, he's going to have a harder time making as much money. And that's just kind of a reality. He wants Walmart, even if residents don't, because Walmart's probably going to be a pretty good cash generator for him. So the favor, if you're a big developer, tends to favor going after those big box stores, because they tend to be more reliable, at least on a medium-term level. They will stick around for a while. They'll make a bunch of money. Whereas mom-and-pop stores, I mean, go to Lawrence on Mass Street, which is a very charming, very nice kind of downtown strip. But if you go 1 month and then visit it again in 6 months, you'll see a lot of turnover in the types of mom-and-pop stores that are there.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'd love to hear from you. Do you live in an older suburb that's trying to spark new life? What kind of retailer do you want setting up shop in your community, and why? 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. You're listening to KCUR's Central Standard. And we're talking about whether we're seeing the tide of public opinion toward big box stores changing. Do you view the ultimate benefit of these retailers any differently than you did in the past? If so, what accounts for your change of heart? 816-235-2888. Our guests are Ben Newman, author of Backlash Against the Big Box, and Steve Vockrott, a reporter at The Pitch who covers development here in town really thoroughly. Hi again, Ben.
Hi.
And welcome back, Steve.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Ben, you know, we were just talking a little bit about attitudes toward mom and pops, and I know that your study didn't go into the why and wherefores of people's opinions. It just sort of cataloged how people felt and what how that related to, like, their surroundings and what was actually going on in their communities. But I wonder if in the case studies you referenced earlier that you have dug through, if you see a changing attitude toward mom and pops that kind of corresponds in some way to a changing attitude toward big boxes.
A little bit. So I think the best way to answer your question is just to think about the trajectory of cities. So a lot of the literature that I dug through in doing the background for the study was just kind of macro level views of how cities have changed from stages or waves of suburbanization in the 50s and 60s and the types of values that people were looking to maximize in those suburban environments, to more recent waves of return to urban areas and the types of things that are pushing people away from the suburbs and drawing them into urban areas. And I think it's just important to note that large retailer stores do offer certain values such as convenience, affordability, and those values resonate with certain things that drew people to the suburbs. I mean, we know from a lot of the case studies that people were drawn to the suburbs for certain values such as convenience, racial homogeneity, safety, things like that. And then we know just further down the trajectory, say, the next generation that were raised in those environments by parents that valued those things may not value those things and instead kind of are bored with the blandness of their environment, and then they seek to go to colleges in urban areas and stay in those urban areas. So back to a point you made earlier about kind of this nostalgia for mom and pops and the types of excitement that you can see among people in very marginal, say, rural areas when big box stores come in as symbols of, wow, now we're finally, linked to the real world. I think that stuff was more meaningful, more important in the absence of the internet and things like that. But you can see that that stuff still happens. But then if you could forecast 20 years down the road, a lot of what we see in communities that have already been there for a while is that there is this disillusionment that sets in after the excitement of kind of joining the modern world. And one great example is the exodus of all these professional class workers from a place like Silicon Valley to San Francisco. This is drastically altering the landscape and the economy of San Francisco. And one of the major reasons is that young people, college-educated, good jobs in Silicon Valley, grew tired of being in suburban environments, San Jose, Cupertino, etc., and said, let's go live in an urban environment where there's character, where there's interesting businesses, and there's more diversity.
That is interesting because I've been reading about trends in suburban revitalization, which, with environments like these experiencing a little bit of a slump, which I think you just described, they're looking to redefine themselves. And one of the ways they're doing that is a process called infill, where they try to create more density and more of a city-like atmosphere in historically suburban areas. And I wonder if that relates to this question of big boxes and the changing attitude in some suburban areas toward them, because part of that whole infill process is having smaller structures that can be kind of stacked on top of one another, whereas the big box structurally is just, a monolith on the horizon.
Right, right. So I want to give a shout out here to a very important institution called the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and one of their head analysts, Stacy Mitchell, who has done extensive research on Walmart's small businesses. And what her work talks a lot about is that precisely that new urbanism where you have suburban environments. I'm originally from Santa Rosa, California. And when I was a college student, undergrad at Sonoma State, there were a lot of these types of controversies over big box stores. And one thing we saw in some of the towns in Sonoma County, which is a rural county, is that instead of trying to anchor development with a big box store, going more for these kind of like central business district revitalizations where you build up, you have mixed retail on the bottom that are all small store spaces, and then office space on the second floor, residences on the third and fourth floors. And these were very popular, and it was this kind of attempt to add character, add flavor, and not kind of promote the kind of big box dependence model.
Let's talk to our callers. We've got Kelly Mack on the line at 816-235-2888. He runs Mack Hardware on Johnson Drive, and he's the third generation in his family to own and operate the store. So it's a mom and pop in the very literal sense. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, good morning, Gina. How are you?
Good. How are you feeling about the news that after 10 years of debate, it looks like a Walmart will be coming to your neighborhood after all?
Well, it's certainly a disappointment for all of us that have been in the Johnson Drive corridor for, we're going on 77 years now. We kind of think that we fit or filled the needs of the community, and to have something like that going on down the street, it's just a disappointment for us all, put it this way, I think.
It came up earlier. I mean, your store was mentioned as a store that might see some repercussions from Walmart's ability to drive down prices on some of the very goods that you sell. Is that something that's of concern to you? I mean, you are already fairly close to a Walmart.
Well, we're pretty close, and they're basically just moving the one down. And we've certainly been able to, for the most part, compete with the one that's just up there in Roland Park. But being a little closer and just on the same drag will certainly be an issue. We do our best to keep our prices sharp here in the store, but there's obviously places where we just won't be able to compete price-wise, and we'll just have to see how the consumer reacts.
So far, I mean, this is the third generation of your family's business, but in recent years anyway, has Mission been a good place for a small business like yours? It looks like a place where smaller shops are thriving, but that's easy for me to say, like, as I drive by and I'm not in your shoes.
It has been over the past, for many, many years, the past, say, 8 or 9 years, it's been a challenge to do business here in Mission because of the redevelopment, the road work, and just the economy itself there in 2009 just went south. So it's been a challenge. Now we're starting to see it come back. I think people are starting to come back to Mission. They're starting to enjoy, the small shops and just the life of Mission.
When you say people are starting to come back, do you have a sense of, like, what kind of people are making a return to your neighborhood?
It seems to be the younger folks are starting to come back. I'm going to say the ones, the 25, 35s. I see a lot of fresh faces coming in our door that want a different kind of experience. That maybe being sharp on price is not exactly what they're looking for. They're looking for somebody that'll actually recognize them. They'll say hi and help them with their needs. So we're really seeing, I think the younger generations are starting to come back to the smaller stores.
I followed your neighborhood's Facebook feed a little bit and noticed that you get talked about a lot as representing the mom and pop style shops in the neighborhood. Do people who feel strongly on one side or the other of this debate tend to see you as kind of a poster child for small businesses?
Well, I've never really thought of it that way, but perhaps. When you go through tradition and, a family business that's been able to survive and all sorts of economic conditions for 77 years now, I would say that perhaps we are in many ways a poster child for the home, neighborhood, community business.
And you're comfortable with just owning that identity?
I think so. One
of the things that's come up in this conversation, not the conversation on the air, but the conversation around development in your neighborhood, is a desire for it to become more walkable. Is that a new conversation, or was walkability something people already talked about, like in your parents' day, maybe even when your grandparents were running the store?
I don't think walkability for our business was ever really considered, no. In my business, people want to get in, get out because they've got a toilet that's broken, they've got grassy, they need to get down, or they need to carry a 80-pound bag of concrete down the street. So walkability is not a huge plus, shall I say, for my business here. Now, in particular, there might be some down the road, the coffee shops, the little dress shops, their walkability probably be good for them. But it never really came up in a conversation that I can ever remember, at least here in my store, no.
Well, Kelly, good luck with everything, and stay in touch with us. Let us know how it's going.
I will. Thanks so much for having me on. Take care, y'all.
Thank you. That was Kelly Mack of Mack Hardware in Mission. Steve, I wonder if walkability is a realistic goal in these inner ring suburbs that were really built with the automobile in mind.
Yes and no. If you look at what Johnson Drive's done, they did a tremendous amount of work. It took a long time to sort of, rebuild infrastructure to make it walkable. But that's just on Johnson Drive. If you go to kind of in the neighborhoods, there's a lot of neighborhoods in the inner ring Johnson County suburbs where there are no sidewalks. There may not be enough traffic on the roads to make it really a hazard, but that may be a long-term infrastructure issue for inner ring suburbs to start thinking about, do we want to get sidewalks into both our residential and commercial corridors?
Let's talk to Helen in Kansas City. Hi, Helen.
Good morning.
What can you share?
Well, as a small business employee, we're just as much concerned with online shopping. You know, people say they want the local mom and pops, but then they go and buy the same stuff online, even though it's the same price, because they don't have to pay sales tax on some of them.
So, yeah, I mean, we really probably should talk about the role of the internet in this whole dynamic. We've talked about change over a period of, 20 years. That's one of the big deals. Ben, how does the internet come up at all in your research and in the larger research on this issue?
Well, it's actually a very interesting question. So another of the studies that I've done looked at the topic of political consumerism, and that's when consumers buy things because they're evaluating other benefits besides price, such as supporting local businesses or the environment. So I think that what we've seen over the last 20 years is an increase in, you know, American citizens' engagement in political consumerism, and coincidentally, people that engage in political consumerism are more likely to be young and college educated, so similar to the types of customers that Kelly was talking about entering a store. And I think precisely what your caller is saying right now is that people express certain values but then engage in behaviors that are not consistent. And we see that across many domains in life. So political consumerism is something that's taking hold with this that could potentially be a benefit to small businesses against things like Walmart or online shopping.
We have just a little time left for this discussion. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman, KCUR Central Standard, back in a minute. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we've got just a little time left for this discussion about the relative merits of big box stores and the old-fashioned mom and pop, and whether the trends in the suburbs are changing. Our guests are Steve Vakrot of The Pitch and Ben Newman, author of Backlash Against the Big Box. I want to get back to our calls. We've got Michael with us in Ottawa, Kansas. Hi, Michael.
Hi. I have a question about what the speakers mean by character. I know in a general sense, a big box has less character than a small mom and pop, but is there any more precise definition than that?
We'll get a little more precise definition, but I'm curious about how you would define character.
It has something to do, I think, with differentiation, things not being the same, individuality standing out as opposed to anonymity and stuff like that.
All right, yeah. Let's see what Ben Newman has to say about how he's using the term character.
So the way I use it is just kind of drawing upon the way it's used in the studies that I've looked at, and pretty much your caller took the words right out of my mouth, that when you think about, say, when a real estate agent takes you around different neighborhoods and says, oh, these are character houses, what they're talking about is this house doesn't look like that house. In fact, the person that designed this house designed the trim to look like this, and it's observably unique to any onlooker. And that's the kind of thing that you would see in the context of a business. You go into a business and, you know, when you go into like a Subway, you don't see something like all the little dollar bills from the first day they were open and names and signatures of people who bought them. There's all sorts of markers and indications that you see in small businesses that you don't see in kind of a Subway or a Starbucks or things like that, that add character to the environment and make people feel like they're not on just a rotator belt or a conveyor belt of experiences, but they're having something unique. I guess that'd be the best way, and it's totally consistent with what your caller just described.
Steve Vakrot, when you look around the larger KC metro, is there a place where you could sort of give a specific example of how you would define character?
Yeah, I can think of a couple just off the top of my head. I mean, if you look at the Brookside shops there along 63rd Street and Brookside Boulevard, and yeah, you do have a couple of chain places like Panera and CVS, but the architecture of those places is a little different than what you'll typically find in some of the smaller independent stores. You know, Reading Reptile is an example. I mean, you go in there and the way it's designed is far different than perhaps your conventional children's bookstore. Another example I would say is if you look at Mass Street, you have a at Mass Street in Lawrence, you have a Starbucks there. And there was a lot of concern in the community when Starbucks went there that it would drive the coffee shops out of business, you know, like Henry's. But if you go to a place like Henry's, there's very much of a sense of place and an environment where you could sit there. If you're a student, you could study there for an hour. If you're there with a couple of friends, you could be there for quite a long time. Whereas the environment in a Starbucks is more of a, let's get our coffee and go.
Do you ever think there is a circumstance of a specific location of one of these chains or even a big box taking on some kind of unique character?
You know, architecturally, you're seeing a lot of you're seeing a lot of fast food restaurants, for example, instead of having a really basic structure, they are, you know, Taco Bell, for example, you're seeing a lot more of kind of like the brick facade. It's still the same. It's still the same Taco Bell inside, but it's, you know, architecturally more appealing. Wendy's has made an effort in certain locations to make it feel more like that coffee shop type environment where people can sit and stay rather than eat a burger and get out as soon as they can. I don't know how well it's worked, but that's certainly what they're gravitating towards, is giving their consumers a sense of place and a sense of being within their establishments.
Steve, what do you think people tend to miss on conversations about big box stores or conversations about developments in Kansas City's inner-ring suburbs more generally?
I think, you know, one of the big struggles with, you know, inner-ring suburbs is, you know, if not a big box store, what's it going to be? And I think that's kind of central to the discussion going on at Mission Gateway. If the current developer can't get it done, can't get it passed, you know, does he have to sell the land? And then what's it going to be? What do the people of Mission, I mean, how are they going to articulate what they want? I've heard people say, you know, we just like to see that area turn into parkland, off-leash dog park. I've heard all kinds of proposals. And how are all those different views going to coalesce if this Walmart plan ends up falling apart? And it's a complicated question, and one I can't pretend to know the answer to. But that's going to be kind of the path forward as, you know, some of these older shopping districts get a little more tired and show their age. How do cities and communities get a better grasp of what they're going to replace that with?
Benjamin Newman, what are questions you have just quickly about how these tensions will resolve themselves nationally?
It's a good question. I think what's really missing, and this would definitely be outside the purview of my disciplinary field of expertise, would be kind of a long-term economic study. So as Steve mentioned, there are a myriad of studies out there that look at the immediate effects of a Walmart or a Home Depot going in on competitive local small businesses that are selling similar products, sales and employment and future. But what I'd like to see is a long-term study that's looking at a bunch of different metrics such as civic engagement, public opinion, the development of a city. So that's one direction I'd like to see research go, and I think that could be a nice collaboration between economists, political scientists, sociologists, etc. And I also think it's interesting to keep track of gentrification. I think that while that is a very different phenomenon in people's minds, I think it's highly interrelated in the sense that what's really pushing young people into urban environments is the search for this kind of character and authenticity.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for this discussion, you guys.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
You can keep talking about big boxes and mom and pop stores in the Kansas City Metro on our Twitter feed. We're @KCURCST.